Hello, and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
It's now official.
I am running to be your new mayor.
Olivia Chow has resigned as an NDP MP, and she's thrown her hat into the ring to become the next mayor of Toronto. The new mayoral candidate is here to talk about her campaign, taxes, and Rob Ford.
The Quebec election is in full swing, and the question of Canadian unity is once again making headlines. McLean's Quebec Bureau Chief Martin Patrickin is here to speak about the separatist campaign and whether the federal government is ready to handle a referendum.
Canada signs a free trade deal with South Korea, our first such agreement in Asia. What does this mean for you, and what impact will it have on our economy? We're joined by Todd Winterhalt with Export Development Canada.
And the McLean's political panel weighs in on the Fair Elections Act and the upcoming by-election for Olivia Chow's old seat in the riding of Trinity Spadina.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to the Hill. It's been months of speculation, but finally this week, the rumors were put to rest.
My name is Olivia Chow. And I am running to be your new mayor.
Olivia Chow announced Thursday that she is running for mayor of Toronto, confirming what you could call the worst-kept secret in Canadian politics. On Wednesday, she sent a letter of resignation to the Speaker of the House of Commons, officially ending her 8 years as the Member of Parliament for the downtown Toronto riding of Trinity Spadina.
In her campaign kickoff speech, Chow took aim at her main rival, incumbent Mayor Rob Ford.
He has failed to make the critical investments our city needs to stay competitive. He has failed to help businesses create jobs. The current mayor is failing at his job.
But Mayor Ford isn't fazed by the attacks.
You know what? They can criticize me all they want. I've got a proven track record, and let's get on with the debate.
In fact, he welcomed Chow to the race, saying she makes former Mayor David Miller look like a conservative.
Aside from the jabs, to talk about the launch of her campaign and what she's telling the voters of Toronto, I'm joined now by the candidate, Olivia Chow.
Good morning.
First off, I guess I want to ask you about your decision to run for mayor. You've obviously been planning this at least for a little while because nobody sort of brings together a campaign team at the snap of a finger. But when was that aha moment? When did you say, yes, this is it? I no longer want to be an MP and I'm going to run for mayor.
It's quite recent. It was a very difficult decision in some ways because I had to quit my job, move my apartment back to Toronto. I spoke to a lot of people. Some of them might surprise you that from different political spectrum. And now I'm in. I'm ready.
How did the conversation go with friends and family?
Some of them are very interested, very excited. Said, Olivia, do it now. Do it tomorrow. I'm in. Others were very cautious. They talked about the work that I was doing in the House of Commons, rail safety, Canada Post, infrastructure funding for municipalities and cities, all of those things that I've been very active on. They said, well, you know, you need to keep going at it, hold Stephen Harper to account. Anyway, putting all that aside, It is time for a change. Our city deserves a new mayor, and that's why I'm applying for the job.
So you sort of talked about what you've done on the federal level, but what are you going to bring to this race for the people of Toronto that is not coming from your opponents?
Well, I have the experience in municipal government. I have the track record to get things done, to work together with others as a team, cutting across political lines, whether they're liberals, conservative, which is why some of them are supporting me, and to deliver better services for children and families, and immigrants too, you know, to phoning 911 and not being able to express yourself if your English is not fluent, it's a problem. And if you're in an emergency situation, the wonderful thing is that 911 now can speak 140 languages, which means that you can get the emergency help that you need. In a city so diverse like Toronto, that's a critically important service. So I have the track record, I have the experience, and so that's why I'm good for the job.
Now, in your opening speech, you made it clear that transit is going to be one of the big issues that you're going to focus on. And it's understandable. You've been pushing in federal politics for a long time for a national transit strategy. But you want to build an LRT in Scarborough and not the subway. John Tory's criticizing this because he says you basically want to reopen a settled debate. The feds have already committed the cash for a subway. Council's already approved the plan. Why backtrack?
Well, I think Scarborough residents deserve respect. They deserve faster service and now, not 4 years, 10 years, 20 years from now. The above-ground train service is ready to, all the studies have been done. The shuffle is ready to go into the ground immediately. Whereas, so it's 4 years faster, four stops more, and $1 billion less. So if you look at the underground option, it still needs 2 years of environmental studies, two more years of study. So you're looking at 4 years of study. The next Winter Olympic would have come and gone. That line wouldn't even have started yet. I mean, the shuffle wouldn't have hit the ground yet.
But do you risk losing some federal funding? I mean, the federal funding is already approved for this specific project to build a subway in Scarborough. If you change the plans now, you'd have to reapply to make sure you have the cash to build the LRT.
Actually, the application have never gone in because there was no application process at this point. So there's a verbal agreement, but we don't even know whether the money is going to come now or later. There is no application. There is no formal written agreement. I checked with the minister when I was a member of parliament, and he said that, well, you know, if the city applied for the funding, yeah, you know, it'll be considered as a priority if yours is a if you put it as a top priority, etc. So, normally also the money may not come till at the end of the construction. So we may not see the money until 4 years from now, right? 3 or 4 years. So that's just a bit risky. I rather have the money that we already have and start building, get shuffle in the ground, rather than waiting for something that is so uncertain.
Now, Mayor Ford has boasted in the past, and you mentioned the minister there. He's talked about his personal relationship with the federal finance minister. He's been seen at many events with the PM. Of course, due to his personal scandals, they've sort of distanced themselves now. But he has shown he's been able to get funding through his connections on Parliament Hill. How do you think your experience as an MP and your connections on Parliament Hill may actually help you in this race?
Well, I do know how both the city of Toronto works and how the federal government works. I have that kind of experience on both levels of government. If you look at Rob Ford's promise, we still don't have any of the money, any money to help fix the Gardner. And it's come spring, the concrete is going to hopefully not rain down like last year on people. Rob Ford can boast all he wants, but I haven't really seen the kind of funding that he said needs to come. What I have done, I've been pushing to have the gas tax indexed, and you know that is happening. The money will flow on that front in 2015. So that's one small little victory.
Are you not at a disadvantage in a way, considering the fact that you were sitting on the opposition benches and now you may be applying to the government that you opposed for funding and to work together on issues facing Torontonians?
Well, I have a track record of working with people from all political spectrum. So if the project or the application is strong, and supported by people in Toronto, then I am sure that other levels of government cannot ignore the people of Toronto. And remember, the new mayor would be working with local neighborhoods and community groups. So it's never just one person. My track record has always been bringing people together and getting things done. So if other governments want to ignore us, I don't think it would happen, because the people of Toronto are strong and we cannot be ignored.
You mentioned jobs a little bit earlier in the interview. What specific plan do you have to create jobs? I mean, every candidate in every election says they want to create jobs. How are you going to do it?
Mm-hmm. That's a very good question. In three areas, working with small businesses to assist them, because they create a large number of jobs. I've spoken to people in the financial sectors, because if you look at our financial services, it's number two in North America, just after New York. It creates a huge number of jobs. And thirdly, the creative industry, that would include the filming and the entertainment industry. It's an area that I know quite well. I represented that area. And again, they create, and that's number two jobs a creator in the city. So those three aspects, working together with all of the stakeholders, we will be able to, they will generate jobs, and I would be able to put the city in a good footing and lessen the unemployment rate in the city.
So just to clarify, will you have specific plans, like the detailed plans of how you're going to work with those industries to create the jobs?
I will.
And that's coming
up soon.
Okay. I understand the way campaigns work, and you don't want to release your whole platform right at the start.
No.
But the other question is also, Rob Ford is attacking you, calling you a tax and spend socialist. So I'll ask you straight up, do you plan on increasing taxes or introducing any new taxes?
I grew up in a family that every dollar matters, and you don't spend what you don't have, and we save for rainy days. So that's why I've always, when I was a city councillor, working in the budget committee under Mayor Matt Lastman or a different metro chairman, we've always helped deliver a balanced budget. And in terms of property tax increase, I will hold the line that it would be in line with inflation. I think that's important. And Mr. Ford, actually, under his when he is the mayor right now, in the last 4 years, we have seen the TDC fares have gone up, recreation fees have gone up, and people are paying more and getting less, and everything. Well, even water rates have gone up by 9%.
What about the user fees that you speak of? I mean, you're critical of Rob Ford about user fees going up. Will you freeze those?
I think it's important that we make sure that life is affordable for people that live in the city. And so, for example, recreation fees, it really have no reason why it would go up. So I would protect the user fees. As to my entire financial plan, I will give you all the specific quite soon. We do have a 7 to 8 months campaign, so
it's going to be a slow rollout of your policies then, eh?
I will roll it out.
Olivia, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate your words today.
Thank you.
That was former MP and now Toronto mayoral candidate Olivia Chow.
Coming up, is the federal government ready to fight a battle of national unity, and what the South Korea free trade deal means for our economy?
Will Quebec try to separate from Canada? That's a question we haven't had to ask in nearly two decades. But with the Quebec election now in full swing and Parti Québécois Premier Pauline Marois seeking a majority, the question of Quebec sovereignty is once again dominating headlines.
Marois has even recruited star candidate Pierre Carpelletto to help her chances of winning a majority. He's the media mogul involved with Quebecor, the company that owns such properties as TVA and Sun News. So how is the separatist campaign going, and is the federal government ready for a showdown on national unity? To answer those questions, I'm joined now by McLean's Quebec bureau chief, Martin Patrickin. So in this week's issue, you have the cover story, and we have on the cover Mr. Pelladeau under the line, "Is this the man to break up Canada?" Without giving away the ending of the story, what were you writing about this week?
Well, essentially, PKP, as he's known here, Pierre-Carl Pelladeau, jumped into the race last Sunday after months of saying that he wasn't going to do as much. He jumped to the PQ, of course, and came out and said that he was in favor of an independent Quebec and et cetera, et cetera. It changes the game significantly in Quebec, certainly around in the ring ridings around Montreal that the PQ is targeting. The thing I argue is basically that Marois has at least temporarily stabilized the PQ and rallied the PQ around her. And by being able to recruit someone with such sort of business bona fides and sort of superstar status in Quebec as Pierre-Carl Pelladeau, says something to me about the sort of the new winning ways of the Parti Québécois.
How, observing this from afar, it seems like it's been a bit of a rough week for the Premier all the same. Has the launch gone maybe not entirely according to plan? Yeah.
Look, if you had told me before Sunday that Pierre-Carl Pelladeau was going to jump into the race after saying that he wasn't going to, I wouldn't be that surprised. I've written about him before. He's kind of an impulsive guy and, you know, sort of has his own whims. Had you told me that he would have stood up in front of his crowd at Saint-Jérôme where he's running and, you know, said that I want to have an independent Quebec and have it for my kids and all that, you know, in saying that he's in a mixed crowd, he's turning off a lot of soft nationalists, a lot of the South nationalist votes that would, you know, are ostensibly sovereignists, but do not want another referendum, don't want to go through the sort of economic uncertainty and turmoil of another referendum. And that really puts Marois in a difficult situation because she's trying to lure those very voters. So it was a fallout for her, but a mitigated fallout, I think. It'll be difficult, as we've seen in the last week, to sort of recover from that. Whether or not Couillard is able to capitalize on that, which seems to be the game plan on this, you know, talk of another referendum, et cetera, over a 20-day campaign, remains to be seen. But you're right; it is to a certain extent not the greatest rollout that Pierre-Carl Pelladeau has ever had.
How, on a scale of sort of 1 to 10, I guess, how freaked out should people be at the possibility that there's going to be another referendum and we're back into a national unity crisis?
It's an interesting dynamic. The getting Pierre-Carl Pelladeau, bringing him into the race 3 weeks before the end of the election, is akin to a sprint. You sort of get the guy in there, and you're able to capitalize from his star power, and you don't have to, you know, you limit your fallout by his the potential fallout that sort of comes with Pierre-Carl Pelladeau and all his foibles. The interesting thing is, should the PQ get a majority? Will it get a majority? It can get a majority without the majority of votes, as happened in 1998, or it could get a minority. In a majority situation, things would point towards the idea that if the PQ wants to benefit from the honeymoon status it would get from such a majority and benefit from having Stephen Harper in Ottawa and not, say, a Justin Trudeau, and sort of benefit from the fact that there is relative cohesion within the PQ, which is bound to disintegrate, as it always does, that they would want to start pushing for a referendum fairly quickly after an election win like that. That's a suggestion, and I tend to believe that.
How this always comes back to Ottawa, at least in Ottawa, it becomes a question about Ottawa and where the federal leaders stand. You write in your story a bit about whether or not the Conservatives are prepared for this. I guess, first of all, what do you think there's any reason for the federal leaders to jump into this question wholeheartedly now? And second, if we get a PQ victory, what does that mean for the federal leaders going forward?
You know, there's always speculation about Harper, who's, you know, was in a former life was a unilingual Alberta, more or less Alberta-bred politician. The idea that he doesn't care about Quebec, and I completely disagree with that, if only for history. He doesn't want to be the guy who's on the watch when Quebec leaves Confederation. As for the other leaders, I think it's a question of, you know, when, not if. Certainly in the case of Justin Trudeau, he already came out this morning, you know, saying that he's really behind Philippe Couillard, you know, and is very much in, you know, it's his tendency to sort of come out and shoot from the hip, certainly on issues of Quebec. If you remember when the PQ introduced its charter back last fall, he was the first person to come out and very emotively say that he was completely against that. You know, that to me didn't smell like a political calculation. It sort of felt like it came from the heart. And I think we're going to sort of see the same Justin Trudeau in this situation. As for Harper, you know, Harper is in a bit of a quandary. In 2006, when he came in, he did away with a lot of the sort of the electoral machinery, the referendal machinery to observe the Quebec mood. Things that were brought in by the Liberals and which were sort of tainted by the Liberal scandal. And one of the arguments I make in the piece is that having done away with that, you know, some of it had to be done away with. Obviously, it was tainted by that corruption that came from AdScam. But it was a, sort of akin to throwing the baby out with the bathwater in the sense that, yes, there was some bad in there, but there's no monitoring, there's no polling, there's very little polling going on, there's very little boots on the ground as far as monitoring the Quebec mood and the referendal situation here that there used to be.
And what about for Mr. Mulcair?
Well, Mulcair is just, Mulcair is probably in the most precarious situation because he has to remember that the majority of his, I think it's 52 deputies that he has in, or MPs that he has in Quebec were elected by the very soft nationalists that the PQ is sort of courting right now. Plus there's the 50% plus one. So all of a sudden you can see why a guy like Tom Mulcair wants to stay out. At the same time, he's got to convince the rest of the country that he's probably best positioned to fight a potential PQ majority government, which is why he came out, I forget now, about a week or 10 days ago, saying that, you know, he's fought two referendums and he's fought the evil separatists. So Mulcair is in sort of like a bit of a schizophrenic situation where he has to keep things calm in Quebec and yet show the rest of the country that he's actually Captain Canada.
How, for those of us sort of watching from afar, because it seems that whenever there's a highly contested Quebec election, it becomes a bit of a national election, what should people be watching for over the next few weeks as this campaign progresses?
I think you're going to see, Peledo, as we said before, is a dream candidate for the PQ, and he tainted that candidacy a little bit with coming out and saying what he said. I think you're going to see Couillard and to a certain extent François Legault of the CAQ hammer like hell on that point, you know, that this is going to mean another referendum, et cetera, et cetera. Those will be the sort of the talking points of those two parties. And PQ, on the other hand, will try to concentrate on the economy and the charter, the whole charter debate. And I'm actually just writing a blog post about that right now. The other thing that's going to be interesting, I think you're going to see, is going to be a real return to a two-horse race situation. Quebecers experimented a little bit over the last, since 2007 or so, well, and then even before that a little bit, with another third party called the ADQ, which became the CAQ, which is now led by former PQ minister and MNA, François Legault. I think you're going to see less experimentation. I think all the talk of referendum and, you know, sovereignty or federalism is going to makes people think twice about experimenting with their vote. I mean, that it's unfortunate because I think Mr. Legault is running a very good campaign right now, but I think the PQ and the Liberals are gonna do a fair bit of damage to his vote base.
All right, sir. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Aaron.
That's McLean's Quebec bureau chief Martin Patrick discussing the Quebec provincial election. Look for his cover story in this week's issue of McLean's Magazine.
Coming up, how Canada is going to benefit from the free trade deal with South Korea, and later the McLean's panel looks at the latest developments with the Fair Elections Act.
Canada has its first free trade agreement with an Asian nation after Prime Minister Stephen Harper traveled to Seoul, South Korea this week to sign off on the final deal.
It gives Canadian businesses access to a booming G20 economy, but more than that, and I can't emphasize this enough, the key supply chains that begin in Korea fan out all across Asia.
It took 10 years of negotiations, but both sides were able to reach the agreement after hitting some snags on issues like Canadian beef and pork exports and imports from the Korean auto sector.
To find out what the deal really means for Canadians and for an expert look at the big picture of Canada's trade with Asia, McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes sat down with Todd Winterhalt, Vice President of International Business at Export Development Canada.
Lots of Canadians, I think, probably have absorbed the message that trade is important to Canadian prosperity. And when they hear about trade with Europe or the United States, they probably think that's important. We've got to make sure we have those opportunities open. But trade with South Korea, I'm guessing a lot of our listeners would think, it's probably of marginal importance to me. Explain why it's important to people.
Sure. I guess to start, South Korea is already Canada's ninth largest trading partner. We have a kind of bilateral two-way trade in and around $12 billion annually. About 3.5 of that is Canadian exports going into South Korea. So in and of itself, the market is already quite important, and it's important for us across a number of industry sectors as well. So it's not a one-trick pony market for Canada. Very much a lot of commodity exports, coal, potash, things that you would expect. But also a lot of manufactured products, light machinery, for example, aerospace, a very key market for many Canadian companies already. Second piece that I think is very important, South Korea as a gateway to the rest of Asia is becoming a more and more common refrain we're hearing from not only Canadian companies, but also their competitors out of the U.S. or out of Western Europe. So Korea as an A-rated, very solid entity in and of its own is a great place to look into the rest of Asia or Southeast Asia going forward. So as an individual market, very impressive, and as a gateway to Asia, also a very interesting play for Canadian companies.
Hmm. It seemed that the news surrounding the deal being struck centered on sort of two themes. One was some reluctance and even opposition in the auto sector forward, and a lot of enthusiasm from cattle industry. There was sort of commodities makers, which did seem to create a kind of a sense of a stark division in the Canadian economy about the view of this. That's deceptive, I take it. You don't think that really reflects the reality of the way Canadian industry would respond to something like this?
It's a bit broader based, I think, than just looking at a sector or two and the impact for the sectors. So when we look at other trade agreements we've recently signed, and whether it's, you've already mentioned the European, the CETA, as it's called, the European-Canada Free Trade Agreement, as you would imagine, much broader base in terms of the number of sectors and countries involved. But even when you're talking about a bilateral deal, such as this one is with South Korea, yes, for sure there are impacts across a variety of sectors, and I think you have to look at it on balance. So there will be some sectors that will have immediate opportunities. Others may come later in the implementation of the trade agreement. As I've mentioned earlier, I think there's a lot of opportunities beyond just agriculture. That was one that jumped out, I think, for folks. But there is a lot of ability to get value-added products, whether it be telecommunications equipment, whether it be aerospace, the airframes themselves, parts and supply. On the automotive side, yes, we did hear some rumblings from Canadian industry. I think it's also important to look at the other side of the coin, which is, as a major producer and in its own right, South Korea also has lots of opportunities for Canadian auto parts supply and involvement in supply chains and value chains.
So that would be Canadian parts going into Korean cars.
Exactly right. And then potentially outside of Korea as well, as they get exported from Korea to the rest of Asia. There's real opportunities for companies like Woodbridge Foam, for example, who would have components.
What do they make?
So they're in dashboards, seats, things of that nature. Mm-hmm. That then would get shipped onward elsewhere into Asia. So it's, again, potentially a new platform for Canadian auto parts manufacturers through South Korea into the rest of Asia.
Could I broaden the question here a little bit? I mean, obviously, you've made a case for Korea, South Korea itself being important. But if we look more widely at the Asian economy, where do we need breakthroughs for Canada? I mean, the obvious obviously people think of China, India. How would you see it?
I would say China and India are top of mind for folks largely because of the size, right? It's the scale of opportunity there, and they've been on people's minds for many years. They remain important.
Why is it hard to get new trade agreements or even partial agreements with those countries?
It's a good question. I think some of it is the complexity of the economies in and of themselves, the number of existing agreements they've got, and agreements under negotiation with other entities. Sometimes it's just simply a matter of what's on the plate for a trade policy creator. We do know, for example, that Canada is well involved in negotiations with India, to use one example, with one of the larger markets on a trade front. I think they're now into the sixth round of negotiations.
It seems interminable. Do you think that there'll be a breakthrough there eventually? Do you have any intelligence on that?
Certainly hoping for one, I think, is the easiest way to put it. I don't have any personal intel there, but I know negotiations continue, and certainly both on the Canadian and on the Indian side, there's a lot of interest to try and get a deal done. There would be significant benefit. I think if you want to tie it back to the Koreas of the world, then as you know, one new market in some respects for many Canadians, that's a great example in Asia. I would say there are probably three other markets that jump to our mind here at EDC immediately. Indonesia being one, Philippines being the second, and Thailand being potentially a third in the Southeast Asia space. Again, Canadian companies are fortunate in the sense that if they get a toehold in one of these markets, they can then use that as a bit of a launch pad for activities in other markets in Asia.
The other part of the trade negotiation pitch that we hear about is the multilateral talk, the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership. Am I saying that right?
That's right.
How does that fit in the mix? Is our bilateral deal sort of where the action is, or is that multilateral approach more promising, or where does it fit?
I think when you see multilateral approaches, you certainly have the benefit of scale, of size of opportunity, and the CETA deal, the European Free Trade Agreement, is a good example. So if you even wanted to do a quick comparison, you look at the CETA, which essentially has a market of 500 million people and a GDP of over $17 trillion,
wow.
Single largest economy in the
is,
world.
Really? Wow.
It's about 10 times the size of what we're talking about in the bilateral with Korea. Mm. So Korea is, you know, roughly a population of 50 million and a GDP of about 1.1, 1.2 trillion. So, I mean, not even close in terms of opportunities that would present themselves. The Trans-Pacific Partnership you're talking about, or the TPP that's being negotiated now, would actually be a larger kind of block than even the European Union would be. Mm. So it would be pushing 780 million people.
How far is that off from fruition, do you think, Todd? Is that like years and years from now? Or?
I think there's a fairly concerted effort to try and get it done relatively quickly. And with the U.S. presence in there now, Canada also actively negotiating with a variety of the Asian partners, there is some impetus to get it concluded. So I would expect it will not take as long as some of these other agreements have done. You know, estimates kind of run out a year to 2 year range, and you can always then maybe push that a little bit. But I would say certainly 2016, I would be a bit surprised if there wasn't something in principle done.
And could I ask one last question? Again, we tend to focus on, you know, hard commodities and products, right? We're moving like car seats, beef, you know, stuff that we think about. And yet I've also heard people say that some of the big opportunities in Asia are actually service industry opportunities. Can you speak to that at all? Is that overstated, or is there something that we should be aware of there?
Yeah, no, I think it's not overstated to make the point. I think what we often see in new markets for Canadian companies is there is a comfort level with starting with the more tangible or
right.
the hard goods.
Right.
So that we're a commodity-producing country, we all know that. So it's in some ways a little bit more natural, I think, for Canadians to see oil and gas or potash or beef, as you say, going to a market. I think more and more, though, as I say, as companies are born global here and as the services piece is critical, you can see huge opportunities, for example, in educational services. And in particular in Asia, there is an amazing appetite for Western-oriented training programs, whether it be university-accredited type education or things that are much more kind of in the workforce, job training, skills training of that nature, just as one example. An absolutely huge market that is looking for that kind of English language, largely type of service provision. We'll also see that across the space in terms of in the information and communications technology sectors. It's not just one-way trade, and it's not just trade in goods. It's also trade in services, in design thinking, things of that nature to help build the future ICT products, whether it's a Samsung telephone, since we're talking about Korea, or something on the aerospace side, in terms of a simulator sale to Asia and the technology behind that. Very much the services piece is important.
Todd, thanks for talking to us.
My pleasure.
That was McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaking about the South Korean free trade deal with Todd Winterhalt of Export Development Canada.
Coming up, our McLean's panel weighs in on the latest controversy with the Fair Elections Act and the upcoming by-election in Olivia Chow's old riding.
It's now time for the McLean's panel, and I'm joined by co-host Aaron Wary and the McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes. Thank you very much for joining us.
Good to be here.
All right, we're going to start off with the Fair Elections Act, and this week more than 150 academics from universities right across the country signed a letter basically speaking out against the changes the government is proposing for our elections. Also, the NDP started their tour to speak out against it as well. What kind of impact are these measures going to have?
Well, it's interesting, Aaron, you were pointing out that there's a parallel between this and what we saw on the census a couple of years ago, where there seems to be just an overwhelming consensus among outside experts that there are real problems with what the government is proposing. But if we accept that as maybe a sort of template for what's going on here, I mean, what would end up unfolding is the government would dig in their heels and push it through, and a couple of years from now, people will be remembering it as a hiccup and rather than a real roadblock for the government. What do you think, Aaron? Is that where it's going?
Yeah, I think there's a parallel there in that you have every expert, nearly every expert now, lining up against the government on this point. We'll see what committee hearings bring. That may bring more of what we've seen over the last few weeks. Maybe the government can produce people that will support their position. If there's a difference here, it's possibly that the idea of a census is even more esoteric than voting. And voting is something that people will take seriously or more seriously than they take a census. You know, Harry Neufeld has made the point that when people, you know, feel that they don't have their right to vote or you know, are unable to vote, they get very angry. And, you know, that may be the reaction that people have to this if they get the idea that somehow the government is fiddling to some degree with how our democracy works. I mean, the other thing is that there's still a month to go, and how much damage can be inflicted and how much can the government sort of withstand if the NDP is out yelling and screaming about this and committee hearings aren't going well.
And speaking of committee hearings, the chief electoral officer, Mark Mayrand, when he went before committee, he brought forward 25 different amendments that he wants to see done to this bill. And there was a little bit of glimmer of hope that there could be a compromise from Minister Pierre Poilievre. But do you think that they're willing to bend in any way on some of the major issues, such as vouching, or is that done? Like, there's no chance at all?
Yeah, it sure doesn't sound like there's going to be any compromise on that. You mentioned the vouching point. I mean, this is the ending of vouching for voters and the end of the use of voter information cards as a sort of way of people who don't have routine ID getting to vote. That's the one area where I just don't imagine the government will back down. They've made that their sort of signature part of the act. If there's going to be compromise, I would guess it'll be on some of the other, you pick from a smorgasbord. The chief electoral officer has raised, as you say, 25 different parts of the act that he's asking for changes in. There's a lot to go on there. If the government can't find something that it's willing to give on in that wide range of measures, they're not trying too hard. And I might point out that they've recently had the example of Jason Kenney compromising significantly on the Canada Job Grant Program, getting a deal with the provinces, and I think the coverage on that has mostly been positive. They might have feared, aha, capitulation, they backed down, they showed weakness, that kind of coverage. Not really. Most of the coverage was, oh, the government goes to the bargain table, cuts a deal, listens to reason. I think they might want to look at that and think, oh, maybe we could at least bend a bit here without it being seen as a defeat for us.
But with that, it's a little bit different when it's provincial governments doing battle with the federal government than the opposition and bureaucrats. Is there any option for the opposition at all to bring about any change? What else can they do here? What else can Elections Canada do aside from what they're already doing, which, as we mentioned earlier, hasn't worked in the past on other bills?
Yeah, there's not much the opposition can really do. I mean, they can raise a fuss in the House. They can try to complicate things. They can go on the road and hold these town hall meetings. They can try to raise as much attention for their complaints as possible and make this as big a debate as possible. But when it comes right down to it, it's, you know, obviously a conservative majority can do what it wants. You know, there are compromises maybe to be made on a whole bunch of issues. But again, you come back, as John said, to this question of vouching and the voter information card, which seems to be the sort of focus of complaint, I think, to a certain degree, and sort of the highly contested issue here. Is the government willing to compromise on that? It sure doesn't seem like it. And that is where I think the fight will be sort of fought, regardless of what else gets compromised on.
Can I make one more comment on that,
yeah,
Cormac?
Go ahead, John.
It's interesting that vouching and voter information card. I interviewed Mark Mayrand this week for the issue McLean's that's out right now. And he said that he thinks the debate there is based on what he calls urban legend. He suggests that the government is sincere in a sense. It's not that it's kind of pretending when it says it thinks there's a problem of voter fraud, but he thinks it's based on the kind of stories that campaigners tell one another about how the other guys cheated at this poll, they cheated at that poll. It's the kind of, you know, kind of down in the weeds, fine grained stuff that people who are really active in politics talk about, and they come to believe. And there's a gap between those legends about cheating and the research that's been done into it, which shows, you know, there's very little of it.
Yeah, kind of looking back at some of the discussion leading up to this, you know, Mark Mayrand appeared before the Procedure and House Affairs Committee a year ago and said, I think basically in response to the Neufeld report, that he was planning on expanding the use of voter information cards. It's really too bad that we didn't start the discussion a year ago on this point. You know, the fact that this legislation has to be through now in time to be implemented for 2015 doesn't leave a lot of time to have this discussion and chase down anecdotes and figure out exactly what's going on and how the system would work. And, you know, that's kind of, I think, from my perspective, is a bit of a frustrating aspect of this.
And we'll switch gears here now from Fair Elections Act to a by-election in Trinity Spadina specifically, with Olivia Chow now leaving, resigning as an MP, running for mayor of Toronto. We heard from her earlier in the show. But there is going to be a by-election, and it's one that there could be a big battle between the New Democrats and the Liberals. Is it a seat that the New Democrats could lose?
Yes, it is. I mean, historically, that was a tightly fought seat between the Liberals and the Democrats. Olivia Chow took it three elections in a row, if memory serves, and with increasing majorities. But it was really, that was Olivia Chow winning it. And in a sense, it was Olivia Chow and Jack Layton winning it, that they have a real resonance with people in that kind of downtown Toronto constituency. So the NDP has to know it's going to be in tougher against the Liberals this time out, no doubt about it.
And Aaron, we saw something interesting with the possible nominee, Christine Innes, her husband, former MP, because of him trying to take votes away from Chrystia Freeland, who is an MP for the Liberals right now. The party has told Christine Innes, we know you have a website set up and you want to run for this by-election, but no, we're not going to allow it. Justin Trudeau promised that he would have open nominations, but we're seeing something different here. What do you think is happening?
I think we're discovering that politics is a messy business. You know, it's one thing to promise open nominations. It's generally a fine idea. But what exactly does that mean? Does that mean there, you know, won't be any candidate vetting, that there won't be any preference shown to certain candidates, that the leader won't take a position on any candidacies? You know, there's still going to be some process within there that stands between, you know, someone declaring that they want the nomination and that person winning the nomination. I think it's interesting in the context of the Reform Act, which is supposed to deal with this sort of leadership power and how things work at the riding level. And I think you're seeing, as we get closer to the 2015 election, how complicated local riding association nominations are and how messy the politics gets down there. And this tension between the idea of sort of a single national campaign and 338 local campaigns, and how do you reconcile those two things?
Yeah,
you know, the Liberal situation is messy, but you know, I suspect it's sort of an indication of how messy it generally is in that world.
All right, thank you very much for your thoughts today. Really appreciated, my co-host Aaron Wary and McLean's Ottawa bureau chief John Geddes.
Thanks, Cormac.
Well, that's it for this week's episode.
Thank you to Toronto mayoral candidate Olivia Chow, McLean's Quebec Bureau Chief Martin Patrica, and Todd Winterholt, Vice President of International Business at Export Development Canada.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.